The Pat Kenny Show
with MasterCard. Share an extraordinary experiences all over the world with priceless cities at priceless.com.
This is News Talk.
On Friday, Netflix premiered Remastered, The Miami Showband Massacre. It's a documentary on one of the most horrific incidents that took place during the Troubles. It brought to the world not only the story of that terrible night in 1975, but also the long road the survivors have travelled in the last 44 years to find out exactly what happened that night. Stephen Travers, one of the Miami Showband, features prominently in the documentary. He's a survivor of the massacre, and he's spoken to us here on the show before about what happened to him and his bandmates and his long search for the truth since that night. Now, Stephen will be with me in studio in a few minutes' time, but before he joins me, I want to play for you a recording from his last visit here, in which Stephen recalls the night of the attack in his own words. We joined the story when Stephen and the rest of the band stopped at a checkpoint. The people at the checkpoint appeared to be uniformed soldiers. The band was travelling home from a gig in Banbridge in County Down, and they were stopped just short of the border.
The atmosphere was actually quite good, but we didn't expect anything less. You know, the only surprise we got was the fact that we were told to line up along the side of the road and put our hands on our heads. And that, I think, you know, that would have been unusual, especially for the lads who had been doing this. I don't think they had been told to do that very often. For me, I didn't really know the drill, so I just copied them. I put my hands on my head and felt like I was in a movie. But the guys sitting down in front of us were, they were telling jokes, and there were the banter with Fran, and Fran was a quick wit, but so it was no problem. And while we were standing there with our hands on our heads, there was a man going around, and he was asking us for our names and addresses. And I heard a click at the back. They lifted the back door, which was about 3 feet from me, and I heard this click. So I reckoned that they were opening our guitar cases. And as I say, we were precious about our instruments. So very naively, I took my hands down from my head, turned around, and actually walked two or three steps back and asked them to be careful with my instrument.
Things developed very suddenly, very quickly.
Yes, there had been a car came up very quickly behind us when we were pulling into the hard shoulder. And now, I don't know whether this man got out of that car or whether he had been there all along, but I didn't see him until later on. He was the last one I saw, and he walked right past me, through us, and stood in front of us. And he was a very impressive looking man. I remember thinking to myself, if I were ever to be a soldier, I'd like to be this guy. He looked cool, almost like the Action Man soldiers that you see the kids play with. He had a lighter colour fatigues. He had a lighter colour beret. And he had a very crisp English accent. But all the banter stopped. All of the sort of relaxed atmosphere, the people who were on their hunkers were now standing up and basically paying attention. But what we didn't see was that there were two men planting a 10-pound commercial explosive bomb under the driver's seat. For years, we thought it was in the back where the guitars were, but we now know from the forensics that it was under the driver's seat. And the plan was that we would be told, everything is fine, lads, off you go. And we'd have driven down the road, and this thing would have gone off, and we would have been framed as terrorists.
The Miami carrying a bomb.
Carrying a bomb.
Jesus. As it happened, the detonators were faulty, or either deliberately or accidentally faulty.
Yes, but it went off, and it was, the whole world turned red. It was like a scarlet. It was like you're living in this, almost like a different world, because everything became very slow motion. I could hear the gunfire immediately, and I went to run away from wherever I could get to. But I found that I couldn't get any purchase on my feet. I was actually in the air. The bomb had gone off and had lifted me up into the air. Next thing, I felt that I was going down through the ditch, because the field in front of us was about a 3 meter drop down. It was about 10 feet down into the field. And as I was going down through the hedge, through the ditch, I felt that I could feel, even through my clothes, every leaf and bramble, every briar, I could count them. It was like I had this amazing sense of, heightened sense of awareness. And then very suddenly, I hit the ground very hard. Now, they tell me that I was shot while I was in the air by a dum-dum bullet, which is specially hollowed out to explode inside and cause maximum damage. So I was hit in the right hip, and it exploded inside into about 15, 16 pieces in my gut. And the rest traveled up through my body, through my left lung and out under my left arm. The felt somebody, either one or two people, putting their arms under my arms and trying to drag me, and drag me about a few feet out into the field away from the whatever was happening, because I didn't know, I couldn't figure out what was happening. And all of a sudden, these people were, there was this, they couldn't lift me because I was a dead weight at this stage. And I remember very clearly the obscenities. I remember the cursing and the swearing and the shouting and our lads crying. And it was, I can still hear it.
They shot your friends, your colleagues, in cold blood.
They shot Brian. Brian McCoy was from Caledon. He was our trumpet player. He was a lovely man. They shot him. He was very close to me when they killed him. I think Brian must have died instantly. He was very badly shot up, without going into the details. But he was close to me. I heard Fran crying out for his life, and he was saying, "Please don't." And they gave him a particularly brutal killing, and Tony Geraghty as well. I heard Tony. Yes, they killed all three of them.
You were flattened by your injuries. They might have come round and finished you off.
Well, there were. I put my face was on the grass. I was, and I could hear them. I pretended to be dead, and I could hear footsteps after a while when the crying stopped. I could hear somebody kicking something. What it was, they were kicking the bodies to check that they were dead. And this man, he was kicking Brian, and he was very close to me, and he just walked a couple of steps over towards me. And it was that, I had a choice then. Do I get up on my knees and beg for my life, or will I stay where I am? And luckily, I stayed quiet. And I was expecting a bullet, because one of them, perhaps the same man with the revolver, had stood over Tony, and even though he was obviously dead, he just fired into his scrotum a single bullet, which was, I thought it was, when I read it afterwards about that, I thought it was one of the most obscene things. So when I'm told later on, by people trying to mitigate this, that these people, I was told by the UVF, well, they just panicked when the bomb went off. Well, that wasn't panic. These people went around and made sure, and they were firing. But the man stood over me, and just as I was expecting him to fire, I was steeling myself to not to cry out. And you know, I'm sure, I don't know if I would have been able to stay quiet, but I heard a voice up on the road, and the voice shouted down in a Northern Ireland accent, "Come on, those bastards are dead. I got them with dum-dums." I was lying there for a while, and I heard Des called all our names. He called Fran, he called Brian and Tony. And I was actually quite surprised that they didn't answer. And then he called me, and he told me that he was going to go for help. And he got up onto the road, and there was a lot of fire on the road. Perhaps it was petrol. I don't know what it was. But the van was obliterated. And then a car came with a young couple in it, and they agreed to take him in. But he eventually got into Newry Police Station and raised the alarm. I didn't know what had happened, because I had to stay in the field with the lads, who were obviously dead, for about 45 minutes, because when Des raised the alarm, the police were afraid to come into the field because, in case the bodies were booby-trapped. And so I was crawling around and telling the lads, you know, you'll be all right, Des is coming back in a minute, we'll all go home. Even though, you know, there was about half moon, the place was bright, it was a beautiful morning, I just refused to believe they were dead. And strange thing, I remembered Fran had introduced myself and Tony to a girl. Fran was excited. He said, I want you guys to meet this girl. She was actually shot. And we thought that, and we were fascinated by this. And it turned out that she had been shot in Belfast and he was killed. And she was injured. So it was, you know, it was fascinating for us to ask. And I asked her, I said, when you were shot, how did you know you weren't dead? It's kind of a strange question to ask, but I was 24 years of age. Right? And she told me, she said, I could feel a gentle rain on my face. And that's how I knew I was alive. So I was lying in the field and everything was quiet except for the burning. And I was looking up at the sky and I was wishing and wishing that I could feel some rain on my face. That's all I wanted.
And that was Stephen Travers telling us the story of what happened to him and the rest of the Miami Show Band in 1975. Well, Stephen is back with me in studio. You're very welcome, Stephen.
Thanks, Pat.
Every time I hear you recounting the story, it chills my blood, I have to say. The Netflix documentary, first of all, your reaction to it, are you pleased?
I'm very pleased with it. I wouldn't change a word or a frame in that. I was delighted.
The reaction you've been getting from others who've seen it, because this is now reaching a wider audience.
Reaction has come from all over the world, from even from victims groups all over the world, South America, Canada, all, you name it, Australia, particularly from Ireland. And I'm delighted to say that I've got lots and lots of calls and messages of congratulations about the documentary. But I was really delighted that one of the first calls that I got was from my friend Alan Black, the survivor of Kingsmill.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that comes across in the documentary is the quest for truth, which even though people were convicted and then released under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, and that the whole truth has not come out.
No, it hasn't. And that's you may be aware, Pat, that I'm part of an organisation called Truth and Reconciliation Platform, which is mostly called TARP. And those two words come together. There can't be reconciliation without the truth. It's very, very important. Now, the truth is we don't want the truth just to punish anybody. In fact, we don't want anyone else punished. There's been too much suffering with that. But the truth must come out eventually.
Now, in recent times, information has come your way, official documentation, letter from the UVF, which implicates MI5.
Yes. All of these things play into the narrative and hopefully put pressure on the people that are denying us the truth. At the end of the day, I suppose what's happened here is that, as you know, we've got a civil action against the Chief Constable of the PSNI and the British Ministry of Defence for complicity in the massacre. And so I can't talk too much about the court case. But for anything that anybody wants to challenge or deny, I mean, that'll be done in court. And the tragic thing is that there are certain documents that they were told to hand over, that they've invoked public interest immunity, cert PII, so that they can hide the information on, say, the people like the Jackal, Robin Jackson, and other aspects of the murder. So, look, as I say, at the end of the day, if they have nothing to hide, where are they hiding it?
Sometimes governments will hide behind rogue elements within the structure and, you know, we will weed them out. That's not a defence that's currently being volunteered in this case.
No, I mean, what they claim is that that it wouldn't do society, wouldn't do the public any good to know the truth about people like Jackson, the Glenanne gang. But I mean, it's that man's been dead. You can't slander a label, somebody's dead. It's just an excuse, because it's also like there's this movement at the moment for some sort of an amnesty, or that there'd be some limitation on the time limitation on bringing some of the security forces soldiers to justice. It's the only reason that they're demanding an end to prosecution of soldiers. It's not for the sake of the soldiers. It's for the sake of the people higher up who they're afraid if they put some soldier into the dock that he'll spill the beans on them. That's what they're afraid of. So the truth has to come out.
And the communication from the UVF and the notion that they might have been charged or instructed, rather, I'll use that word, is clearer, with killing Charlie High.
That you're referring to the letter.
Yeah.
So many people say, you know, this is ridiculous, and why would they write a letter like that? I'm not saying whether it is or it isn't.
With a UVF letterhead.
Yeah, it was. Look, I was very sceptical, and I did ask people, I can't say who, but I asked people if this was real, and the answer that I've got back, yeah, it is authentic.
The question of the Irish government and what the Irish government, and this is, we're talking about over a period of, 40 years plus, what Irish governments knew and did not disclose.
Trying to get to the bottom of that. What I've been told, and what the excuse is, that is, if they were, you know, if there was, say, for instance, extradition from south to the north or north to the south, that it was inconvenient because it would be demanded in, you know, in kind. So perhaps that's the case. All I am interested in is that the truth of all of this thing comes out.
You say that you've had what would be called an enduring personality change since that time.
Well, when we took the case first, I had to be assessed, reassessed by a psychiatrist, and I was expecting to be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I thought, well, you know, at the worst case scenario, that would be it, that I'm traumatized. And I do realize now that I am, and so is everybody else. My wife, everybody, you know, drive into the north and you're effectively gone into a country where everybody is traumatized. That's the way I feel about it. But the diagnosis came back that I had a condition called enduring personality change, and I had never heard of that. Basically, what it is that you enter an event, a situation, as one person, and you come out the other side as a completely different person. And as I say, I had never heard of it, but it was explained to me. Say, for instance, you were a banker or an art dealer or a dentist or whatever in Warsaw, a Jewish, mm-hmm. before they were taken away to the concentration camps, and when they're, you know, if they live through it and they come out, they're completely changed, completely different people, different personalities. But they tell me there isn't a time frame on that you can actually, it can happen overnight, that you can be changed completely. And I remember asking my wife, you know, not so long ago, I said, you know, did I change? And she said, it was like learning to live with another person.
Wow. Mm. So there'll be no going back to 24-year-old?
No, I missed it. I tried to do that. I was very, very keen. Even when I was in hospital, I wanted to get my life back. You know, when the psychiatrist, at that time we were assessed as well for small claims thing or instruments and things like that, and the psychiatrist was, you know, was saying to me, I think you've managed this thing too well. This would have been maybe 6 months, a year after the incident, and he'd say, I don't like the idea that you don't seem to be traumatized. And so he said, I think I'll treat you with sodium pentothal, which is the truth serum that they inject you with this thing, and you talk it out in a controlled, safe environment. And I said, well, look, as far as I'm concerned, you know, there's nothing wrong. I managed to get through it. I went to a gig on the way back. The lads were murdered and I was injured, but I'm fine now. So eventually he said, okay, well, you might be one in a million or one in 10 million that can, you know, strong enough to get through this. But he said, I have to warn you that in 6 months or 12 months or 5 years or 10 years, and the term he used, the phrase he uses, he said, the wall might fall on you. And it was 35 years later when the wall fell on me. I was in Warrington giving a talk where the IRA murdered those two children, Tim Parry and Colin Ball. I went to talk, and I'd gotten great confidence because I had been invited on the talk circuit by my friend Michael Gallagher, who lost his little son in Oma, and we were speaking at universities and at Radicalization Awareness Network conferences throughout Europe. And I had very confident, and it gave me sort of a sense of worth. I went to talk at this event, and my voice went. I didn't know where I was. Just completely lost. I thought I was back in the field, and
and
I cried for the first time in 35 years about the event.
Did that turn out to be therapeutic, or did you have to go to get help then? Finally, when the wall had fallen on you,
it took me 2 years to get my confidence back, and without my wife Anne and my daughter, I don't think I'd be here today. It was so. What it did for me, Pat, was that it gave me an empathy with other victims. Up until then, I refused to say I was a victim. Up until then, as far as I was concerned, I was a survivor. But after that, that was a big, big change.
Your whole thing now is about truth and reconciliation and resolution. Therefore, as you say, no reconciliation without the truth coming out. How hopeful are you with the Netflix documentary and its wide audience that you will get some final resolution of all of this?
Well, there are, you know, our story is just one. It's the tip of the iceberg. There are thousands and thousands of other people that we meet through our organization, Truth and Reconciliation. I think it will put pressure to one of the great problems, one of the great failings of the peace process of the Good Friday Agreement. The only, and it is very, very valuable. It gave us peace. But one of the great problems is that it did not deal with the victims' issues. So hopefully that it will. I'm hopeful that that we can work through it. As you saw at the end of the documentary, I engaged with the UVF. Now I have been engaging with them since 2007, since our book came out. And this was an opportunity. We went to them and said, "Look, we're doing this Netflix film. Will you take part in it? Because we believe that there are people." We try to identify people within organizations like that we call Champions for Peace. And there are people within the UVF that we feel are Champions for Peace. There are others on both sides who, and not just both sides, on people within all the sides. Loyalist Republican and the Army, that feel that they were denied some kind of a victory. There is no victory. And they're keen to restart the conflict, and Brexit looks like the excuse they're all looking for, but there is no there is no possible victory except peace and reconciliation.
Stephen Travers, thank you very much.
Thank you, Pat.